For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're going to be closing out our series on Revelation, starting in 21, verse 7, and then finishing to the end. And we're going to be looking at glimpses of the new heaven and new earth. But I think that before we actually get into our passage, it'd probably be worthwhile to do a little survey of different views of the afterlife, because there are a lot out there. And I think the typical thing you see with people is that they like to take certain aspects of this religion and then certain aspects of that religion. They like to mix it all together, whatever they feel like fits with whatever they want. And typically, even though people will say, I really believe in Eastern religion, their concept of the afterlife fits more with the Christian perspective than the Eastern one. You know, one view is universalism. In the end, we all win. Doesn't matter if you were a faithful follower of Jesus or if you were Joseph Stalin, you're going to meet the same fate. And anybody really who falls within that range, morally speaking, they're good too. And so the idea is that there is no punishment, there is no hell, everybody makes it into heaven. And as we talked about, even though it seems appealing that everybody would make it into heaven, it does create some problems philosophically and theologically. Namely that if God simply compels all people to be in his presence, then it nullifies free will. What if there are people who don't want to be in a relationship with God? Are they going to then be forced to be in heaven with him? Not to mention, it causes serious damage to the justice of God for him simply to overlook moral wrongdoing, serious acts of moral failure and evil in the world, and to simply turn a blind eye to that. Another view would be naturalism. This is the idea that we're just a bag of stuff. Material. And the idea is that when you die, you just cease to exist. You go back to the earth and, you know, you live on in some respects in the sense that people will remember you in their hearts, but even that fades eventually, and over time, all sense of who you are and your existence on earth is completely wiped out. Another view would be annihilationism. This one's actually gaining some popularity in Christian circles. This idea is that there is, in fact, an afterlife, and that after you die, there is a judgment, but that those who die apart from Christ, who don't believe, that what happens to them is that they experience finite punishment, but eventually, over time, their existence dissolves into nothing. And so they're extinguished. And that deals with the problem of how can God sentence somebody to eternal punishment when they've committed a finite amount of wrongs. Now, even though I find that to be an appealing perspective, because I do want to see God's justice in the Bible, I don't think it really fits with what we see biblically. For example, in Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, Daniel explicitly states, and Jesus quotes this in the New Testament, that multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, and by contrast, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And so there's a parallel there. We want to accept the fact that there's everlasting life, continual joy in the presence of God. But if we're going to accept that, then we also have to accept this other part here, which is that those who die apart from Christ will experience utter shame and everlasting contempt. The parallel construction forces us to see this as an everlasting thing. Another view is reincarnation. You know, monistic religions such as Buddhism or Hinduism teach that you go through an endless cycle of death and rebirth, and that over time, as you get rid of the karma in your life, eventually your destiny is either to be extinguished in the Buddhist perspective, or in the Hindu perspective, that your life simply merges into the all. In a sense, you're like a drop in a vast ocean of water. And the Bible really, I think, speaks in direct contradiction to this. For example, Hebrews 9:27 says it's appointed once for us to die and then to face judgment. And so the Bible says that there's only really one shot. Once we die, we can't make any more decisions. We can't choose for God at that point. And so the decisions that we make in this life, particularly the decision to receive Jesus Christ and His forgiveness, is tantamount to whether or not we're going to be spending the rest of eternity with Him or apart from Him. And then you have soul sleep. This is the idea that, you know, you die and then you kind of sleep for a really long time until Jesus comes back and then you're resurrected. And so you're just taking a really long nap when you die. But that's not what Paul says in Philippians 1, verse 21 through 23. He says, to live is Christ and to die is gain. He doesn't say to live is Christ and to die is to take a really long nap. He says, I'm torn between the two because I desire to depart and be with Christ. So he's saying that once he dies, he knows that he's going to be instantly transported into the presence of God himself. And so even though we may not experience our full resurrected bodies, according to some views, we will be in God's presence, conscious. And finally, you have the cartoon version of heaven, which is, I think, what most of us would imagine when we think about heaven, you know, where all of us are, you know, kind of chubby. We have a diaper on. We're floating in heaven, playing a harp, bored out of our minds. You know, it sort of seems like hell, actually, when you think about it. And, you know, you say, well, do you want heaven or hell? And you're sort of like, well, explain what heaven's like. Well, you're going to be chubby and you're going to be in a diaper playing a harp forever. And you're just like, I don't know. It's kind of a toss-up. I'm not sure. You know, no wonder people are resistant to the idea of heaven in our culture. They think that it's going to be utterly boring. A number of reasons I think that people have concluded this. You know, when we talk about this picture of what heaven is, what looks like, I think the reason why people view it this way, first of all, is the influence of Neoplatonic thought on early and medieval Christianity. This is what Randy Alcorn, in his book, Heaven, which is like a 500-page book on heaven, it's excellent, he argues that Greek thinking has bled into Christian theology. That, you know, Plato taught that there was the carnal, sort of physical, earthly things, and that in heaven there was something that was more pure, which, you know, the earthly or the natural was merely a shadow of. And so there was a tendency to view the physical as being bad or carnal and the heavenly to be awesome. And so, you know, Christian thinkers who have been influenced by Plato and the Greek thinkers naturally gravitated toward that. They had a hard time seeing, you know, heaven being a place where you experience physical pleasure, because they instantly connected that with sin and things that are bad. This is what Alcorn says in his book. According to Aquinas, neither plants or animals will have a place in heaven, the world of light. He argued that there would be no active life in heaven, only contemplation. Something obviously a medieval scholar would think heaven would be like, just sitting there contemplating the universe. He says, because God is the great object of our worship, Aquinas supposed that we would think of nothing and no one but God. They claimed that heaven couldn't be made of familiar elements such as earth, wind, air, or earth, water, air, and fire. Instead, it must be made of a more noble element, the fifth element. The quintessence, which must be something like pure light. I think Alcorn's right on where he recognizes that, you know, it was this Greek thinking that had bled into Christian theology that has led to people thinking that, heaven is kind of like this ethereal place that you go to instead of something that's more concrete, which the Bible describes. You know, another reason is that hardly anyone teaches about it. For instance, in Reinhold Niebuhr's book, Man and His Destiny, he devotes nothing to heaven. That's crazy that a theologian would write an entire book about the destiny of the human race from a theological perspective and say nothing about heaven at all. For instance, Louis Burkhoff, in his 784-page systematic theology that's regarded by most today as the standard systematic theology that Christians should read, it devotes one page in the entire systematic theology to heaven. No wonder people are confused about heaven. Now, let's look at what the Bible has to say about this. And let's start back at Revelation 21, verse 1 and 2. Remember, we read this last week. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So this one phrase there in verse 1 that's a little troubling, that there's no sea. Remember, we explained that the sea often described the nations symbolically as people who are in open defiance against God. And so most likely this is a symbol. But what is literal here is this idea of an earthly city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And the description that we're given in the rest of Revelation here in chapter 21 and 22 is one of a physical city that comes to earth. And, you know, I think that this is probably troubling for some of us because most of the time when we think of heaven, we think of a place that we go to. But the fact is, in the final age, we won't go away to heaven. Eternity will be spent here on the redeemed earth. That's probably surprising to you. That this earth, God will recreate it. He will redeem it. He will protect us from natural disasters. You know, one of the curses that we see in the Bible that has come from human rebellion is the fact that we are under the curse of ecological disaster, that God has withdrawn his protection from natural disasters. And so as a result, we are constantly toiling against nature, not only to provide for ourselves, but also that nature can devastate our lives and take our lives as well. But apparently God is actually going to redeem the earth and we're going to be living here. In addition to that, we'll occupy the new earth with physical resurrected bodies. We'll be recognizable. We'll be able to recognize one another. But it's clear that our bodies are going to be different. They're going to be imperishable. We're no longer going to experience the aging, the effects of time through aging that deteriorate our body. We're not going to experience disease that takes away our lives. And finally, we're never going to experience death again. And so God gives us this incredible promise of giving us new and restored bodies. Also, our fallen human nature will be eradicated. We'll no longer be jealous of one another. We'll no longer compare ourselves to one another. Can you imagine that? How would your relationships be if your fallen human nature was completely eradicated? It's hard to imagine. And that's exactly the way it's going to be. People are going to love one another. They're not going to be selfish. They'll be looking to glorify one another instead of being self-centered and trying to draw attention to themselves. And most importantly, heaven's not going to be boring. It's going to be exciting. Again, Alcorn comments on this. He says, our belief that heaven will be boring betrays a heresy that God is boring. There's no greater nonsense. Our desire for pleasure and the experience of joy come directly from God's hand. He's the one who made our taste buds, adrenaline, sex drives, and the nerve endings that convey pleasure to our brains. Remember, we were talking about the 1,000-year reign of Jesus, that we're going to be eating, drinking alcohol. You know, we're going to experience pleasure, physical pleasure. God is the one who created those instincts, those appetites. And a lot of times we mistake our desire for those things as being sinful, when the reality is it's that we allow those things to go into overdrive that causes the sin, not the desire itself. Likewise, our imaginations, our capacity for joy and exhilaration were made by the very God we accuse of being boring. Are we so arrogant as to imagine that human beings came up with the idea of having fun? Did we invent wit, humor, and laughter? No, God did. We'll never begin to exhaust God's sense of humor and his love for adventure. I mean, God is probably the funniest person ever. And he's not going to be telling puns. He's going to be telling good jokes. The real question is this: how could God not be bored with us? Won't it be boring to be good all the time, someone asked me? Note the assumption. Sin is exciting and righteousness is boring. We've fallen for the devil's lie. His most basic strategy, the same one he employed with Adam and Eve, is to make us believe that sin brings fulfillment. However, in reality, sin robs us of fulfillment. Sin doesn't make life interesting, it makes life empty. It doesn't create adventure, it blunts it. It doesn't expand life, it actually shrinks it. Sin's emptiness inevitably leads to boredom. When there's fulfillment, when there's beauty, when we see God as he truly is, an endless reservoir of fascination, boredom becomes impossible. Heaven is going to be filled with not only physical pleasure, you know, within the parameters of what God has said is good for us, we're also going to be learning. We're also going to be investigating, exploring. It's going to be an adventure. Now, as we go to the main description of what the New Jerusalem looks like, we're told in verse 9, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So he's instantly transported to this high place, probably to get a good vantage point of what he's about to see. And there's a direct parallel, too, between the language that's used here in verse 10, that he carried me away in the spirit, and what's described in chapter 17 of the beast. John, we're told, is brought up to a high place, carried away in the spirit to see the fall of Babylon the Great. And so by contrast, God is showing him something great, the contrast to Babylon the Great, the holy city of God, Jerusalem. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. So it shone with the glory of God. God himself will actually make his presence known in the city. He will be present. And again, when you read the Old Testament, this idea of the glory of God represents his presence on earth. It filled the tabernacle. It filled the temple. And it fills the believers in Christ. And one day it will fill this new Jerusalem, the city that God brings down to earth. In addition to that, he says that its brilliance was like a very precious jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. I'm not exactly sure what John is describing here, but it is striking, though, that, for example, in Revelation chapter 4, John uses the same sort of descriptions to describe the throne room of God himself. And so apparently when John sees God and his presence. It's this incredible light that emanates from God and his throne. Verse 12, it had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels on the gates. The gates were written, the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, and there were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. So apparently, on each gate, which there were 3 on each side, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, 3 on the east, 3 on the west. And on each gate was the name of one of the tribes of Israel. Verse 14, the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And so in addition to that, there were 12 foundations to this city which contained the names of the apostles. And so what this describes is believers symbolically of all generations, both in the Old Covenant and in the New Covenant, are going to be occupying this New Jerusalem. That's going to be amazing, to be able to meet some of these believers. You know, this means that heaven will be filled with God's people from all the ages. Imagine being able to talk to Isaiah, being able to talk to Elijah. You know, some of us are going to spend eternity with these people, and we're going to be able to sit down with Moses, you know, with a craft beer in our hands. Be like, Moses, man, tell that story again about the look that Moses had, or that Pharaoh had on his face as the waves of the Red Sea were crashing down on him. I love that one, man. It's going to be awesome. And I'm going to have some questions. I'll tell you what, you know, one of the first people I'm going to interview is John Mark. I'm going to be like, dude, what were you doing running naked in the Garden of Gethsemane? Why were you streaking, dude? We're going to be able to talk to believers who, you know, we read about. We read their stuff like C.S. Lewis. Be able to talk to Francis Schaeffer. It's going to be amazing. We're told in verse 15, the angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. And the city was laid out like a square, as long as it was wide. He measured the city with a rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length, as wide and as high as it is long. So this thing is a perfect cube. And 12,000 stadia is roughly equivalent to about 1,400 miles. So this is a massive cube descending down onto Earth. To give you an idea, 1,400 miles would be about from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada, from the Appalachian Mountains to the border of California. So that's, it would cover almost all of the United States. And Randy Alcorn actually thinks that this is literal, and others do as well, probably John Walbert. And he did some calculations. He's like, this place is going to be so enormous, the city, that it's actually going to be 2 million square feet, which is like 10 times the size of New York City and bigger than, you know, India. And he points out that if this thing is 1,400 miles high, he's like, maybe there are floors to the New Jerusalem. He says if you do the math and give a generous, you know, ceiling height of about 12 feet per floor, you would have 600,000 floors in the New Jerusalem. Okay, now, it's possible that this is literal. I don't know. I don't really have a problem with, you know, the length and the width. My problem is sort of with the height. Because, you know, the Earth's atmosphere, the outer limits of our stratosphere is about 20 miles high. The outer limits of the Earth's atmosphere is about 200 miles high. I think the space station is like, I don't know, 500 miles above the Earth. So, I mean, this thing would be so enormous that it would like throw the Earth off of its axis. I mean, if you saw Earth from space with the New Jerusalem hanging off of it. It would just be looking, you know, look weird. I think that maybe this is at least the measurements are symbolic of something else that we see in the Old Testament. The only other perfect cube that we find in the Bible is the Holy of Holies in the Old Testament. It's a room where God said, this is where I am going to fill my presence with, and it needs to be a room that is perfectly cubed. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant was contained, which most scholars believe represented the footstool of God. And so we know, for instance, in Hebrews chapter 8, that the tabernacle itself is merely a shadow, a copy of the heavenly tabernacle. And so it might be that this is a depiction of the heavenly tabernacle descending and that heaven and earth coming together. This is what D.A. Carson says in his book, For the Love of God. He says, the cube is symbolic. There's only one cube in the Old Testament, and that's the most holy place in the temple, where only the high priest could enter once a year, bearing blood for his own sins and for the sins of the people. Now, the entire city is the most holy place in the consummation of all of God's people are perennially in the unshielded splendor of his glorious presence. It's possible that that's what it is, that this is representative of the heavenly tabernacle, God's presence merging to earth. But it could also be literal. You know, one of the things that I don't want you to conclude here is that this is purely symbolic. Because even though something is symbolic, it may also be real. Let me give you an example. You know, when you think about my wedding ring, it's a symbol of something, but it's actually a real object. And so it might be that the measurements are symbolic, but the city is literal, that it's real. Another example that we see is actually in Revelation chapter 11, the description of the 144,000 sealed believers. We argue that that's a symbolic number, but there's actually a large number of believers who are Jewish who turned to Christ at that time during the Great Tribulation period. So the numbers may be symbolic, but those people are real. They're literal. And so my best guess is that this is probably symbolic, but the city is real. Verse 17, he measured its walls, and it was 144 cubits thick by man's measurement, which the angel was using. So it might be that this part is a literal description of the city gates. Again, it's kind of crazy if you do the calculation. 144 cubits thick, a cubit is about 18 inches, and so this would be about 216 feet thick. This is going to be a really thick wall. And we're told, verse 18, the wall was made of jasper and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. Obviously, John is using perspectival language. He's having a really hard time describing what he's seeing. Verse 19, the foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedon. Donnie, the fourth, emerald, the fifth, sardonyx, the sixth, carnelian, seventh, crystalline, the eighth, beryl, topaz, chrysoprase, I've never even heard of some of these, jacinth, I know that one, and amethyst. So when you look at all of the different gems, there are 12 of them, and when you look at it carefully, it actually correlates with the jewels in the breastplate of the high priest. And so, again, it's probably symbolic of the 12 tribes of Israel. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. Wow, so that must be a massive oyster. Or, again, it could be that this is, you know, perspectival language. You know, when you look at a pearl, it's iridescent. And so it might be that he's describing something that's iridescent, but he's having a hard time describing that in first century language. Also, we're told that the great street of the city was pure gold. You know, we think that gold's really awesome and precious. And God's like, dude, we make the streets out of this stuff. You know, the pothole crews are looking for the potholes and they're just filling it with gold. Like, what? I'm not even sure there are potholes in heaven. But again, it's clear that he's using perspectival language because it's transparent like glass. Again, we're not entirely sure what he's describing here. He's probably trying to describe something that is beyond, you know, his language. Also in verse 22, he says, I didn't see a temple in the city because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. You know, we talked about what the temple represents, that it represents the presence of God on earth. And so now the temple is completely eradicated. It's nullified because God himself dwells in the city. Verse 23, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its light. This again, this vision touches on an Old Testament passage. In Isaiah 60, verse 19, no longer will you have the sun for light by day, nor for brightness will the moon give light, but you will have the Lord for an everlasting light and your God for your glory. And so the brilliance of God will light up the entire city. Verse 24, the nations will walk by its light and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. I think this is an interesting verse because it indicates that there is a vibrant social life coming in and out of the city. Not to mention the fact that we're told that there are going to be different nations and kings of the earth who are going to come to the city. This fits with what we know of Revelation and really the description that we get of heaven, that there are going to be people from every tribe, language, nation, and people group occupying heaven. So it's going to be a multicultural place. Verse 25, on no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. And so, you know, this description here of the gates never being shut is emphasizing the absolute safety and security that we enjoy in the New Jerusalem. There's no worry about enemies. There's no worry about, you know, terrorism. There's no worry about people coming and invading the land that we live in. Instead, there's complete safety because God himself will protect us and we'll be living in a place where there are no threats. You know, imagine what your life would be like if you never worried about that. People coming in intruding your house. Never had to lock the doors. Never had to worry about your family members, your friends getting hurt. I mean, all the anxiety that we have based on that is going to be wiped away in the new earth. Also, we're told in verse 26 that the glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Again, this is interesting because we're not told that they will bring God's glory. Instead, it says that they will bring their glory and honor into the New Jerusalem. And what some students of Revelation think is that this is describing the kind of activity that's going to be in the New Jerusalem and in the New Earth. That people are going to be spending the rest of eternity learning, creating, cultivating, building, and even playing sports. That the glory that people bring into the New Jerusalem will be their achievements. And so, you know, we think that a lot of times that heaven is this boring place. We're not going to be doing anything, but just the opposite, really. We're going to be learning. Science will continue. Exploration will continue. You know, we'll be creating things. You know, art, music, literature. We'll be cultivating. You know, some of us are into gardening, into landscaping our homes. We'll be able to do that. We'll be building. You know, think about the architecture in heaven, how incredible that's going to be. And also, we're probably going to be playing sports. You know, we'll be watching sporting events. We'll be enjoying it. People will be devoting their lives to that. And it's going to be sweet. And most importantly, we're going to be learning about God continually. How long do you think it takes to know everything about an infinite God? And that's what, you know, that's one of the things that we're primarily going to do. We're going to be learning about God and knowing Him in a deeper way throughout the rest of eternity. It's going to be amazing. Verse 27, nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does not or who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so this is the one qualification of heaven, namely that the people who can enter into the new heaven and new earth are those whose names are written in the Book of Life. We talked about this last week, that entrance into heaven is not about, you know, you doing good things. It's not about you trying to be a good person. It's strictly about whether your name is included in the Book of Life. And the only way that it can be put in the Book of Life is by personally receiving the forgiveness that Jesus purchased for you on the cross. But God, again, is not going to force that upon you. He's not going to force you to be in a relationship with Him. You have to freely choose to do that. All right, Revelation 22. Then the angel showed me the river of water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God of the Lamb down the middle of the great city, the great street of the city. This probably is alluding to the life-giving water that Jesus promised. In Revelation 21, verse 6, he says, to him who is thirsty, I will give drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. The fact that it's flowing from the throne indicates that this is the water that nourishes the nations. And, you know, I think the other thing that this points to is the fact that the new earth will be filled with beautiful natural features. That's one of the things I love doing. I love traveling. And I've had the privilege of traveling to a lot of different places. You know, I think about what heaven's going to be like. And I think I touch that sometimes when I go traveling and I see something that's spectacular. You know, when you wake up in the morning in the Lauterbrunnen Valley, which is this lush valley surrounded by, you know, mountains that are, you know, spiraling around you that are snow-capped. You know, being on Highway 1 in San Diego as you're watching the sunset, and I'm sitting there after a bike ride, 60-degree weather, perfect weather, sitting there on the beach watching the sunset and spending time with God, you get glimpses of what heaven's going to be like. Or, you know, being at the veranda in probably one of the most remote parts of Cambodia, sitting there reading a book about theology, overlooking the South Thai Sea. It's amazing. And I think to myself, that's what heaven's going to be like. It's going to be a taste of what it's going to be like there. The fact is, since this is going to be the new reclaimed earth that's going to be redeemed, it's possible that all of those features are going to be here. That all the different places that I'm like, that's on my bucket list of places to go, I'm going to have the rest of eternity to be able to see all those things. And more. Who knows? I mean, just use your imagination. Maybe there'll be some sweet space travel by then. Yeah. Be sweet, man. Honestly, I think it's not just about the places, though, that you see that make them so memorable. It's also about sharing it with people that you love. You know, isn't that what makes traveling with people and seeing these incredible places on earth memorable is the people that you're with? I remember the first time I ever went to Holden Beach, which is our annual beach trip. It was 2000. And, you know, at the beach, you don't really do anything. You sit there on the back porch and you just, you know, look out into the vast ocean. And you hang out with people, you drink, you have a good time, you talk about spiritual things. And I remember my first beach trip, there was this moment where I was sitting there with my friends, people that really loved me. And we were talking, I was having a beer as the sun was setting. And there was literally a moment that I remember, it was so vivid, where I just felt so content and happy. You ever feel that way? It's fleeting, though. It lasted about 5 minutes. There was just so much joy that was welling up in that moment. That's what eternity is going to be like. Spending time with people. Spending time with God. Perfectly content. This is what Randy Alcorn says. He says, the most ordinary moments on the new earth will be greater than the most perfect moments in this life. Those experiences that you wanted to bottle or hang on to but couldn't, it gets better, far better than this, and it will. He says, life on the new earth will be like sitting in front of a fire with family and friends, basking in the warmth, laughing uproariously, dreaming of the adventures together, and then going out and living those adventures together. With no fear that life will ever end or that tragedy will descend like a dark cloud, with no fear that dreams will be shattered or relationships broken. You ever notice that old people travel a lot when they get old? It's because they know, I don't have much time left. We'll never have that. We'll have the rest of eternity to spend with one another. We're told in verse 2, on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. In Genesis, we're told that in the middle of the Garden of Eden, which was the original dwelling place of humans, there was the tree of life. And that in human rebellion, people were not only cut off from God, they were also cut off from the tree of life, which resulted in death. And God says, I'm going to recreate that scene so that you can live the way you were meant to live, in perfect unity and harmony, untouched by death. We're told in verse 3, 4, and 5, no longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and there will be no more night. You know, in this passage, John describes three different ways of describing the healing of our relationship with God. First of all, we're told that his name will be on our foreheads. Namely, that he will completely, at that moment, purchase us. That we'll be fully redeemed at that moment. We'll be his. Also, that there will be no more night, which is a metaphor for the moral wrongdoing, the infection of sin that continually robs us of the true joy that we can have with God. You know, as believers in Christ, we can experience to some degree closeness with God, but nothing like what we're going to experience in the new heaven and new earth. We're going to have unbroken, close, intimate relationship with him. I can't even imagine what that looks like. You know, imagine if God were to say to you, you know, you should go and do this. Imagine thinking to yourself, without any hesitation, yeah, that's perfect. I should do that. It's good. With no doubt about his motive, no cynicism about his character, pure childlike faith, pure childlike trust in God, who we love. And finally, we're told we will see his face. You know, last year when I went to Cambodia, and every time I go there, it's really hard to be there. Because you fall in love with the people, the place, the culture. And when I was on the plane ride, back home, I was kind of sad about that. But I knew that what I was going home to was my 2-year-old son that I hadn't seen in 2.5 weeks, and I longed to see him. And when I finally arrived at the airport, I was so happy to see him. Imagine one day being able to see the person that you love the most. The person you love more than anybody else. That's going to be Jesus. You're going to see him face to face. So why is it important to study heaven? Because the rest of Revelation 22, which we're going to blast through, is an epilogue. Why is it important for us to think about this? I think the first reason is because thinking of heaven changes the way that we think of this life. Focusing on heaven changes what we do here and now. You know, some theologians say that Christians are worthless because they think too much of heaven. It's just the opposite. C.S. Lewis says, if you read history, you'll find that the Christians who did the most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. The apostles themselves who set foot, the conversion of the Roman Empire, the English evangelicals who abolished the slave trade, all left their mark on earth precisely because their minds were occupied with heaven. It's since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they've become so ineffective in this one. When you know that your time here is short and that you're going to a better place, there's a sense of urgency. There's a sense of urgency to live a life and to carry out the mission that God has given to you. And when we lose sight of that, when we're confused about what heaven is, it has direct implications for the way that we live now. I think another reason why it's important to study heaven is because seeing the end helps us keep going when we're struggling and suffering. Randy Alcorn tells this story in his book of this woman who at one point in her life swam the English Channel. And she at one point decided that she was going to swim from the Catalina Islands to the coast of California. And so she was in the water for 15 hours. There was this engulfing fog. She couldn't see anything. Her mom was next to her in a rowboat, telling her, you know, keep going, you're almost there. Tired and exhausted, at times she wanted to quit. But her mom kept egging her on, just keep going, you're so close. And finally, after that 15 hours, she said, I can't do it. I'm physically exhausted, I'm mentally exhausted, I'm going to quit. And so finally she got into the boat. As she approached the shore, the fog lifted and she realized that she was only half a mile away. When the interviewers talked to her afterwards, she said to them, if I would have known, if I could see the shore, I would have never quit. I would have kept swimming. And sometimes the fog of eternity covers our eyes. We can't see it. And so we attach ourselves to this life. We need clarity. We need to think about the future. Think about where we're going to be for the rest of our lives and allow that to determine the way we live now. All right, let's read the rest of this. They will not need the light of the lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. The angel said to me, these words are trustworthy and true. The Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his servants the things that must soon take place. Behold, I'm coming soon. Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy in this book. I think that's an interesting statement. You know, Jesus is pointing out this is not about us having an intellectual exercise to try to figure out all the different nuances of our end times view. It's about a practical thing, living out what God says here. Verse 8, he says, I, John, am the one who heard and saw these things, and when I had heard and seen them, I fell down and worshiped at the feet of the angel who had been showing them to me. But he said, don't do it. I'm a fellow servant with you and your brothers and the prophets of all who keep the words of this book. Worship God. Then he told me, don't seal up the words of the prophecy of this book because the time is near. In Daniel was told to seal up the prophecy because the prophecy did not concern the present age that he lived in. But John here is told not to seal up this prophecy because it not only pertains to that time period, but also to Christian believers throughout the ages. Verse 11, let him who does wrong continue to do wrong. Let him who is vile continue to be vile. Let him who does right continue to do right. And let him who is holy continue to be holy. Behold, I'm coming soon. My reward is with me, and I'll give to everyone according to what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may go through the gates into the city. You know, this washing of the robes is specified in chapter 7, verse 14. That they've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. The white robes represent righteousness, symbolically. And again, what John is emphasizing is the fact that it's only through what Jesus did that we can actually have our robes washed and experience the righteousness of God. Outside of the dogs, those who practice magical arts, sexual immorality, murderers, idolaters, and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David, the bright morning star. All the titles that have already been given to Jesus in chapter 1. The Spirit and the bride say, come, and let him who hears say, come. Whoever's thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him plagues described in this book. If anyone takes words away from this book of prophecy, God will take away from him his share in the tree of life and the holy city, which are described in this book. He who testifies to these things says, yes, I'm coming soon. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. The grace of the Lord Jesus be with God's people. Amen. And there you have Revelation. If you're a first-time guest here, we have a free book for you. If you have any questions about Christianity, it's called Discovering God. It's an excellent book. And you get a free drink, too. Next week, we're going to be studying Colossians.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.